No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard Time on this 20th day of March during what history will record as the end of Texas's first full week of the pandemic of 2020. The numbers of Texans testing positive for coronavirus changes by the hour, an institution doing the reporting. As of last night at 8 p.m. Central, the Texas Department of State Health Services reported that of a little more than 2,300 people tested statewide, confirmed cases stood at just under 150. But over the weekend, we are likely to see all of Texas's numbers spike dramatically as more tests become available and as community spread accelerates. I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us. It's hard to make comparisons with that other big state on the West Coast where more people have been tested and there are some 1,000 cases confirmed. But if trends out there lead the rest of the country, as so many people think it does, well, it's worth noting that Governor Gavin Newsom has ordered all 40 million Californians to stay home under penalty of misdemeanor charges and has indicated that martial law could be imposed to stop the spread there. There are exceptions to the stay-at-home order, of course, but as we'll discuss later in the broadcast, the Texas governor has now declared a public health disaster, something the Lone Star State has not done in almost 120 years, effective through April 3rd, prohibiting gatherings larger than 10 people, closing bars and gyms, forcing restaurants to switch to takeout or delivery, closing all schools, and prohibiting visitors at nursing homes. What a lot of people are hoping and waiting for is a vaccine. Several days back, we spoke with Dr. Peter Hotez of the Baylor College of Medicine, who mentioned having a prototype, but according to many published reports, a vaccine remains 12 to 18 months away at least. Well, we've got questions, as you might imagine, and Dr. Maria Elena Botazzi likely has some answers. She co-directs the Center for Vaccine Development at Texas Children's Hospital and Baylor College of Medicine. Dr. Botazzi, welcome to Texas Standard.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to join the conversation.
When our listeners hear that there's a prototype out there, that sounds, like something's imminent. But other researchers, as I mentioned, have been pretty firm about this 12 to 18 month timetable. How do you square those two things? Is there a vaccine just waiting for funding or what?
So, there are several prototypes, as you have heard, not necessarily only the one that is currently stored in our freezers here in Houston, but we have many that are being currently attempted to evaluate. So, indeed, all of them will most likely have to go through the same cycle of evaluation. And yes, it's probably going to take between 12 to 18 months to finally start getting some evidence of whether any of them will be not only safe, but maybe with a hint of efficacy.
Now, forgive me for interrupting, but the president has said that he has instructed the FDA to fast-track some of these experimental approaches. What does that do to the timetable? Does that help advance it or not so much?
So the fast track can go at a couple of levels. One is, of course, that the FDA then prioritize to review documentation that is specifically related to interventions that address not only the COVID-19 or any parallel or complementary interventions, but at the same time, it may give some ability to the FDA to, without cutting corners and certainly without jumping over any very regulated step, that they could evaluate the feasibility of doing things in parallel rather than doing things sequentially. You know, normally the FDA most likely would take a little bit more higher risk-averse position, but in these days, I think they are cognizant without jeopardizing the safety and certainly the regulatory requirements. They probably can look at things faster, but at the same time, looking at whether things can be done complementary.
Now, the White House says it has asked researchers to look into using an anti-malarial drug as a possible way to treat the coronavirus, saying scientists have claimed it might help. But the World Health Organization has said there's no evidence of that, no proof. How does something like that affect the work that you and others researching a vaccine are doing?
Well, indeed, it's a crowded space, right? We scientists would like to make sure that we present as many options as possible. So, for example, in the area of vaccines, We, of course, have groups, including ours, that very much are focused on developing a very specific COVID-19 vaccine. Mm-hmm. But we also would like to evaluate vaccines that maybe were partially developed already for another coronavirus. And in our case, for instance, that vaccine that we have in the freezer was really developed for SARS back in 2003, not for COVID-19. So again, it's the line of prioritize interventions that would be directly addressing COVID-19 versus those that maybe can be repurposed or reevaluated. But the argument should, however, always be backed up with scientific evidence.
Obviously, everyone wants to make sure that bottlenecks are removed as people in your position work toward a vaccine. One question that I think a lot of people have is how much of this is related to funding? I mean, is the lack of funding prohibiting you from doing more work or research on the prototype that Dr. Hotez was telling us about, or not right now?
You know, it is a tricky question because indeed you need funding and you need resources as much as you need time and, of course, as much as you need transparency of sharing the data that you get as you go. So, yes, it is a bit of a bottleneck because even funders themselves, I am sure they're feeling the pressure and the stress of how do you prioritize, who do you give the money to,
right.
And how much money is enough money? I mean, arguably, you know, there's probably never going to be enough money. I think our position is that, you know, those decisions indeed by these funders who some have you know, a lot of funds that, you know, maybe they need to reprioritize where they're putting the funding. And that, of course, has the challenge that most likely they're going to take them away from something else. I mean, I don't think money can just be created brand new. You know, it's probably going to have to be taken from another already allocation.
So there's competition there is what
yes,
you're suggesting.
Yes. And so, and I think for us, the worry is, one, that indeed there will never probably be enough funding to be able to support everything and anything. We appreciate that they have to be mindful of how they distribute those funds. But however, it has to be a real balanced, equitable, transparent way of how are these eventual funding decisions are made. You know, we certainly work in a space that we would like to see our work primarily for the nonprofit mission, mm-hmm. that is going to be affordable, accessible, that we have the same opportunity of advancing our innovations and technologies. Knowing that we are not a big pharma, we certainly don't have stakeholders. We do not have venture capitalists that are putting money into this. All that we do is in the context that it is all done in the nonprofit with no wish to make any commercial gains out of this.
Right.
And so we want to caution, you know, certainly the public that, yes, it's fabulous to have a lot of, you know, very innovative technologies, a lot of them. However, sometimes you see enormous amounts of news coming out of these biotechs and private pharmaceutical companies. They're great. It's fabulous to see them, that they're trying to participate in this huge public health global problem that we have.
But they can create false hope as well.
Yes, there's that possibility. Their influence can also jeopardize groups that are really genuinely trying to also push this with a global public good perspective. Mm. For example, that will those technologies eventually be readily accessible and affordable to groups outside of the United States? Will anybody be able to eventually license these technologies?
Right.
And bring them to India, China, Latin America, right?
And we've already seen this question politicized.
Exactly. So, you know, if anything, we just caution all interventions, I believe, should have the same right of being evaluated, evaluated scientifically, evaluated ethically, evaluated regulatorily, evaluated logistically. Mm-hmm. We all should have the same opportunities to seek to garner funds, whether it's federal, private philanthropy, a huge foundation, certainly, these global funds, and be certainly transparent of how the decisions are mm-hmm. being made, of why some have been more successful than others. Is it A, because they're private and they have some influence? Is it, again, like you mentioned, I hope it's not being driven by political decisions. Ultimately, the decisions have to be made certainly to ensure safety of our population, accelerate as much as we can, but at the same time, be mindful that this is going to be products for the public good, and no one should be doing this with an ulterior motive of eventually have any gains. These are very different type of vaccines in the case of vaccines. They're not vaccines that will be sold to the general public, right? I mean, these are emergency preparedness, stockpiles type of vaccines that eventually they're going to have to be kept and maintained, most likely with a strong support by the government mm-hmm. agencies, because they have to be made available to the population rapidly and most likely even for free.
Dr. Maria Elena Botazzi co-directs the Center for Vaccine Development at Texas Children's and Baylor College of Medicine. Dr. Botazzi, thanks so much for spending a few minutes with us on the Texas Standard and explaining the situation with vaccines.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.